We have learned of the great fall. Adam, the representative head of the human race, had a great fall. It was a terrible fall that brought consequences upon himself, but it was also a terrible fall for the whole human race that he represented. It brought consequences, long-term consequences upon them. Now, we've seen the effects of that great fall. We know that Satan is now an enemy of God, of man, and he is malicious. He's always trying to cause harm to man. Then, secondly, we note that man has now got a sinful nature, which inclines them naturally in the direction of sin, of disobedience towards God. And thirdly, we learn that the whole creation has been affected by sin, and the whole creation, therefore, affects us as we live in this world, so we cannot expect good but evil in this world that we live in. So we come to the second talk in this series, entitled The Great Flood. And just as there was the great fall, there came next a great flood. And this flood affected the whole earth, destroying everything, leaving only one family with some creatures that God did not want to destroy. Other things were all totally destroyed. And when the flood subsided, Noah and his family and all the creatures had a new start in this world. So Noah was like a second Adam, the second man. The whole human race descended from Adam through the three sons of Noah. So in this talk, entitled The Great Flood, we are going to learn of a new start from the second Adam. Now the first section is, why the flood happened? We ask the question why. Then we are going to ask the question how, and finally we are going to ask the question what. So why the flood happened? Now, man now has a sinful nature, and as man spread over the earth, as man multiplied, they began to get worse and worse, and some became obviously ungodly. Others attempted to remain godly, but what we find recorded for us in the Bible is that the godly seed began to court the ungodly seed. Now actually, we are to remain pure and separated to God. Don't be influenced by the devil. Don't be influenced by sinful people around us. How many of us are so easily influenced? Some more easily influenced than others. You go to school, some friends ask you to do something wrong, you know it is wrong, and yet you do it with them. Why? You see, we have already seen that we have a human nature that is sinful, that is inclined to evil. Left to yourselves, you will naturally turn in the direction of doing wrong. So when your friends ask you to do wrong, it's easy to do wrong rather than to do right. And of course, you can't excuse yourself for that. God holds you responsible for your sin. And that was what happened as the human race multiplied. Some began to become worse and worse, allowing the evil desires, the sinful desires, to take control of them. They just simply couldn't be bothered and just did what was wrong. And others were more obedient to God. Although they were inclined towards wanting to follow their friends, but deep down in them they knew that God will not be pleased with that. And they decided to do what was pleasing to God. So you discover that there were those who remained godly, who would worship God in the way that He has prescribed. Since the fall of Adam, God had already taught them that they must now approach Him in a certain way. No more could they interact with God directly like before. Remember, God appeared often in the form of man and walked in the garden and had close fellowship with Adam and Eve. But that became different when Adam and Eve were driven out from the Garden of Eden. Fellowship was broken off, and God required Adam and Eve now to come and show their submission to Him by bringing animals as sacrifices to worship Him. So Remember, animal sacrifices did not begin from the time of Moses. A lot of Christians get that wrong. It actually began from the time of Adam. When Adam sinned against God, God actually slaughtered animals and put skins around them to cover their nakedness, which was more effective than the fig leaves that they tried to sew around themselves. But the animals were actually used to worship God. That is why we read of Abel, who offered up sacrifices that was acceptable to God. And that's why we read of Cain, who tried to be too smart and approach God in his own way. And instead of bringing animal sacrifices, he brought the produce of the ground. He brought grains and other fruits to offer to God. But God must be obeyed in exactly the way he had commanded. You don't worship God as you like. The same principle applies today. You don't approach the Yang Di Pertuan Agong as you like. You don't dress casually as though you are going to play football. No, you must dress properly if you want to see the king. And you must follow the palace protocol, the palace rules. So also when you come to approach God in worship, you must worship him in the way that he has prescribed. And the way he has prescribed was that you must bring animal sacrifices. But why? God had a reason. The reason was that God wanted them to know that they have forfeited life. Now they are dying and they have been separated from God. Therefore, it's not just physical death that they have experienced, but also spiritual death. Therefore, in order for them to have life, they must come to God through a sacrifice. An animal must be laid down. Its life must be laid down on behalf of the person who is approaching God. This was the point to the coming of a perfect sacrifice, who turned out to be the Lord Jesus Christ. So in those days, God was already trying to tell the people, you must approach me only because somebody else has died in your place. Blood must be shed for the cleansing of your sin. A life must be laid down on in your place so that you may have life. So that was the way of approach that God wanted them to carry out. And some remained faithful to God doing that. Some did not. They began to be like Cain and did as they liked. You see? And if they worship God as they liked, you can imagine that in life they would do other things as they liked. And again, I believe I speak to people who know what it is, what this is all about. Sometimes they're tempted to want to do things. I know it's wrong, but... And you do it. And you have pangs of conscience after that. And remember, all sins have its consequences. Some consequences are long-term and long-lasting and devastating, terrible, you see. Some sins you God graciously overlook, and in some ways you pay for it in a minor way, and then the scar is often left there. But the point of the matter here is this. The godly people of those days, known as the sons of God, these people began to look at those ungodly people, and they began to think, you know, somehow they are beautiful, attractive. And they began to court these people and began to marry them, when from the beginning it was clear that the godly state should remain separate from the ungodly people. That is why up to today we keep teaching from the Bible that true Christians must marry only true Christians. A true Christian don't marry a non-Christian, even a so-called Christian in name. Too many people are Christians in name in the church, you see. And you find them attractive, and you say that, you know, she is a Christian, or he is a Christian, you see. But actually, you know that there's no sign of spiritual life in the person. There's no desire for spiritual things. The person is actually as carnal, as worldly, as fleshly, as the non-Christians outside, you see. So in God's eyes, those are unconverted people. Although they are in the church, but they are unconverted. Don't court such people. And when you marry an unbeliever, you are doing something displeasing to God, and you have to pay a price, a heavy price. Now, when love is there, everything seems so nice, so good. Everything also can. Malaysia boleh, we also boleh, you know. But you discover soon, tak boleh. Really, tak boleh. You see, you discover differences occur. Differences are so deep. Because one is spiritual. He has been made spiritual by the Spirit of God. You appreciate spiritual things. You can understand spiritual things.
You can worship God through Christ who is your Savior, but this person is dead spiritually. He tries to carry out the motion of religion. He will come to church. He may even learn to utter some prayers, but the prayers are not from the heart, because the heart is basically unchanged. So you see, therefore, that how can these two go on living together happily? You discover that there will be problems. And very soon you discover one wants to go one way, another wants to go one way, and marriage binds you together, and you discover your direction in life is so very painful, so full of unhappiness. See? Just because at the moment everything is bole, but you discover for life that everything is bole. You see? So what I'm trying to say to you is, God meant well when He gave us the command that believers must remain separate from unbelievers. Marry only a person who is truly a believer. Remember, when you marry a person who is truly a believer, you are already facing trials, because you are a sinner and the person is a sinner. Although both are saved, both have spiritual life, we are still not perfect in this world. It is until we arrive in heaven that things will be perfect. And so imagine two persons, two sinners saved by God. Yes, two believers getting married. Already we are troubled by our own sins. Let alone you marry an unbeliever, or a Christian only in name but actually unconverted. You see? More problems will come. And that is why we know that it is for our good that God gave that command not to marry an unbeliever. And of course you say, you know, but unbelievers can be converted. Yes, but make sure that they are genuinely converted before you marry the person. Because sometimes people come and marry you by pretending to be a Christian because he loves you. So you say, you know, yeah, I believe. I come to church. I get baptized. And if the church is not careful, and many churches are not careful today, they just want big numbers. They just simply baptize anyone. You see? And you see, that person will be baptized and you will be regarded as a Christian. But you discover there's no spiritual life, no spiritual desires. His life is not controlled by a desire to please God, to obey the Bible. You discover it too late. You get married to a person who is not genuinely converted. Then that's why you face with a lot of trials. That's why we mustn't. We mustn't. We must marry only a believer. And that was what happened at that time. The sons of God, the believers, began to find that the children of man, those who are fleshly, those who are unconverted, to be so attractive. And so they began to take them for wives. You read in chapter 6 of Genesis verse 2. See? And you see that, of course, you see, as the human race propagated, the influence of the godly will be for good. Even non-believers benefit from the good things. And even non-believers are capable of good, because God is gracious. He caused a lot of good to be in this world. That is why some unconverted people are very clever. They are able to do a lot of things. But what they have not done is to acknowledge their God, to worship their God. You see? And you see, what is the point of being so great in this world but you don't have God? You see? It will come to nothing. And your greatness, remember, comes from God. God gave you life. God gave you health. God gave you the brain. God gave you the ability. And God gave you all the opportunities. Now all this we must acknowledge. But people in the world, they become too smart. Oh, I have the brain of an Einstein. I'm so clever. You know, I don't need God. You see? And you come up with all your theories of the origin of man and so on. No. That is pride. You see? Now in those days, there were already great people like that. Great conquerors. Great hunters. Great builders. Great inventors. Great musicians. Great composers. They were already found in those days, and we read of them in verse 4. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Now when Christians influence non-Christians, of course it is for good. See? Good will come. But the point is that the influence is often one way. You're giving and you get diluted, get depleted. the world will never give anything good to you in return. Because you see, there's nothing in the world. You know what it is like. When water is high here and there's no water there, the water will flow downwards. When water flows and flows, very soon it will be empty. And there's no water flowing upwards. Why? Because in the first place, the world has no water. Nothing good in it. No spiritual life. So when Christians contribute to the world benefits. But the Christians get depleted of all their spiritual vitality and soon they become like the world. So that is what happens when you marry a non-Christian. Of course the non-Christian will benefit. But what happens is that the Christian becomes depleted of spiritual life, becomes like the world, and very soon you can't do more. You become useless. Okay? And that was what happened. And you see, when that happened, when Christians began to blur the clear line of demarcation between believers and non-believers, when that clear line is blurred, when you begin to compromise, it's never mind, I marry her first maybe and one day she will be converted. Now what happened is that there is no genuine conversion and your spiritual life is affected and very soon you also live like a non-believer. See? And then the next generation of children will not be raised up in the way they should go, and then by that time, everyone has become non-Christians. And you see, all this grieved God's heart. Because evil then spread, and spread, and spread. And the few Christians around are getting lesser and lesser. The few believers are getting lesser. And so you see in verse 6, and the Lord was sorry that he had made men on the earth. He was grieved in his heart. Imagine, we often read of the papers and hear from the news. A rape has occurred. Another one has occurred. A murder has occurred. And another one has occurred. And all the bad things seem to be non-stop, one after another. And that is our experience. We see it. No? We talk about September 11. Then we talk about Bali bombing. And then we talk about Jakarta bombing. And when would it be KL bombing? You know, we hope it will never happen. You see? And it causes us to be unhappy, to be worried, to be anxious. Then we hear of a rape and murder and we thought, you know, that's already very bad. We feel very strongly, we feel that the murderer must be arrested. The truth must come out. He must be properly punished. You see? But then the next thing that happens is you hear of another case. And as though that is the end, you hear of another case. There seems to be no end to this type of things. See? Now imagine, if it grieves you, it causes you to be anxious as you walk in the streets at night. You begin to wonder whether you should go elsewhere and find a better country elsewhere. But you know that there's nowhere on this earth that is better. You see? Now, if all these around you affect you, just think how God looks at the whole world. God was grieved. At that time he was grieved. You can imagine today he's very much grieved. But then, you see? What is going to happen? What is going to happen to the promise given to Adam about a Savior coming? You see? Now God on the one hand had to keep that promise. On the other, the human race was not fit to live anymore because they have sinned against God so terribly, getting worse and worse. And remember, God is a patient God. God is long-suffering. But when the Bible explains and tells us that God was grieved in his heart, you can imagine how far the human race has gone in its sin. See? So that was the situation. So God must act. God must act. And so what happened was that the first thing God did was to limit the lifespan of man. Verse 3. We are told there, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. Before this, you know, human beings live hundreds of years. You can't imagine that, you see. But that was a fact. Hundreds of years they live, you see. Because the human race was at that time stronger. It wasn't affected by sin too much yet, you see. And there were few viruses around. There were few diseases and people's constitution was stronger, although decaying and dying, but nevertheless, they live up to hundreds of years old. See? But God decided to put a limit to their lifespan, 120. See? And later we discover in the book of Psalm 90, you know.
He tells us that God has set the limit to 70. If we are, God is gracious, 80, that is the average. Some people still live up to 100, but you hardly find anyone living above 120. The majority die by age 70. And a number die by age 80, but very few live beyond that. So you see that God had to limit the lifespan of the people. Otherwise, more and more evil will be in this world. More and more evil people are running around, planning, plotting, you know, killing and murdering and going against God and shaking their fists at God and thinking themselves so proud, so clever, so smart. You see, it grieved God terribly. He had to limit their years. But things didn't get any better. It got worse. Until we read there in verse 6, Adui, you see, when we are told that God was sorry for making man, that his heart was grieved, it must have gone that far, okay? And so God had to destroy the human race because the human race has forfeited the right to live. They have gone so far as to be so worthless in the sight of God. They really have become so bad. See? And so what happened was this. God saw only one family, Noah, his three sons and their wives. They have preserved themselves pure. Only one family. Of all the families, of course we know that in those days the number of families wouldn't be that many compared to today. But the fact is that, you know, out of perhaps how many hundreds or a few thousand of families in those days, or even more, we do not know. But the fact is that of all the people, only one family was found faithful to God. See? And you see in all this, why the flood happened. The world had become so wicked. And yet, you see, when the flood occurred, you must understand, two things. Firstly, God has been holy and very patient with man. And you see, there is a limit to his patience. If God has no limit to his patience, then it is no more patience. To be patient means you can tahan, you can control, you can not punish the person yet. But the time has come when you have to punish. Otherwise, you can't call that patience. You would have to say that is indifference. God is not bothered. That's why there was no limit, no punishment. But because God was truly patient, that's why he allowed them until the point came when he couldn't allow them anymore. So the first point is that when God really judged, he has already shown forth his holiness and his patience. God is holy and very patient. Okay? If he did not have a limit to his love and his patience, he would not be what he is, God. You see, but because he's truly God, he truly has love and he was patient towards the human race. Then the second point that we need to note is that human nature is so bad. You see, when we say we are sinful, do you understand how bad that is? You see, God gives us a bit of leeway, allowing us time to understand, to turn. But we don't. We take advantage of that. Go worse and worse and worse. And just because God haven't judged you in your sin yet, you think you can go on doing as you like. And worse still, you get more bold, more rude, and more daring in doing bad things. So it got worse. Okay? And so what we want to take note of is that there was a good reason why the flood happened. Because the human race has really gone beyond the limit of God's patience. So in the second section, we consider how the flood happened. So we have asked the question, why? Now we ask the question, how? So why the flood happened now? How the flood happened? Now God commanded Noah to build an ark, a big ship, and the dimensions and the instructions were given exactly to be followed by Noah. And knowing Noah, we know that he would not question God. God, why has it to be so long? Why has it to be so wide? Why three stories? Why not just two? Or why not five? You see? No. Noah obeyed God's instruction. What was given to him, he did. See? And God was generous and kind to Noah by giving him a reason why he was doing so. He commanded Noah to do so. He tells us in verse 13, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence to them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth." So Noah was given an understanding. God was now going to judge the world. And by building the ark, Noah already got an idea. That means flood is going to come. Water is going to come somehow. But how? The rivers are far away. We are building on land. Where are the seas? No, there's no indication of seas there. You see? And you ask me to build on dry land? And such a big ship? Huh? How am I going to push it to the sea to make it work? Noah did not ask questions like this. Instead, God told him in verse 17, "And behold, I myself am bringing flood waters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die." Now Noah got the urgency of the situation. He knew that this was terrible. He knew. And therefore, his heart was anxious for the people. You see? So, you must imagine, he was born a son of Adam. I mean, he was descended from Adam. There will be others who will be related to him. And he has three sons married to three women. And these women would have parents and brothers and sisters. So he would have relatives. His concern would be for them. And these relatives would have other relatives. And perhaps they might be closer to them in terms of their relationship than by blood. Sometimes it happens, isn't it? Those who are not related to us by blood are closer to us than those who are related by blood. And we are concerned for them as well. The more good friends we are, the more concerned we are for them if there is danger. And so what happened was that Noah increased his urgency of preaching to the people around. You say, where does it say in the Bible? It doesn't say there in Genesis chapter 6, but the point is that we know that chapter 6 revealed to us that Noah was a godly man who knew God's word, and therefore he would be preaching God's word. And this is confirmed by the New Testament in 2 Peter chapter 2 verse 5. Listen to this, what it says there. You see, starting from verse 4, let me read. It says, "For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into the chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of the eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes," and so on. Note what it says in verse 5. Noah, one of the eight, a preacher of righteousness. He preached, telling people that God demands a certain righteousness from us. He wants us to turn and obey him. Follow him. Repent. Turn. God's judgment is going to come down upon us. Don't you see that we have sinned against God so grievously? And I have received revelation that God has reached the limit of his endurance with us. He is going to punish us with utter destruction. Turn from your sin. Come back to God. Come to worship him in the way he has prescribed. But you see, these people did not listen. They did not listen. And you see, what would you expect when people are stubborn and disobedient and rebellious? As parents, you know what you do? If your children are like that, what they deserve is a thorough spanking. And you have to do it if you really love your children. Otherwise, they will be spoiled. Their characters will become hardened. They will grow up to be hardened criminals. Yes! One day they will be the ones who murder and rape and kill and commit all the terrorism. Why? Because from young we have not dealt with them the way we should. When they are young, when their characters are moldable, see? And sometimes, pop! That's what they require. No? Yes, give it to them properly. And the cane is a very useful tool to drive out all the foolishness out of their mind. Out of their hearts. The Bible tells us that the heart is full of wickedness. Only the rod of correction can drive those out. See? Drag them somewhere to one corner. Give them a thorough whacking. normally we would suggest you sit down. You are the one who is in authority. Sit down. Make the person stand there before you. Reason with the person. Do you know what wrong you have done? Why it is wrong? Don't you deserve punishment? And they will have to acknowledge, yes, it's the case. And now I have to punish you. See, I have to, because I'm your father. I'm your mother. See, I love you. That's why I have to do so. You see, otherwise God will not be pleased with you and with me. So hands up. Slash. And it must be painful enough to make the person learn not to want to do that again. No, it's no point using the cane. Just to, you know, I'll do it, you know, I'll cane you, you know. You're only threatening. But you never did it. And that's why the child began to wonder, is he true or real or not this time? You see? And then one day you lose control, right? You see? Then the child begins to, why one moment no caning when she said she will cane, but the next moment cane. You see? You get the child enough, it will work. It will drive out all the evil out of your heart. And what we did, when they really get out of control, was that the caning was not just here. Whack the legs, whack the backside, ask them to bend over. Give them properly. See? And the cane wouldn't break their bones. It would split their skin and blood would flow for a bit. Just a little bit. Now a bit of blood oozes out of me. Their teachers would come and say, what your parents do that to you? No, we should go and complain. Let them say what they like. Your children are under your authority. You have a responsibility. Even if the law is passed to put us in jail, we know from God's word that it is our duty to train our children in the way they should go. Okay? And you can imagine that if we as parents have to do that to our children, we have to, based on what God has done to the human race. You must understand how God was tested. God was provoked until the limit came and he had to do it. And this time he really had to wipe off the whole human race because they were not fit anymore to live. They were not fit. They have arrived to the point where they are not fit. And in society, sometimes it's like that. See? Some people are murderers, rapists, serial killers and so on, to the point that all jail sentences and all rehabilitation efforts will not work, and they continue, and even on trial they will tell the judge, you know, the moment I release, I'll do that again. Well, such people do exist because their hearts have become so hardened. See, imagine the people in the world, the whole world shaking their fists at God, laughing at God, you know, hoo-hoo-ha-ha here and there, you know. No? Blaspheming God to that extent. They really have become unfit to live. God really have to wipe them off. Just as you crush the ants, habis, you know, the human race have to be finished off. You see? And you can't blame God. Because the human race has forfeited the right to live. Okay? Now, so Noah throughout that time was preaching. You see? The time came when Noah was commanded by God, move into the ark. And I'm going to send these animals two by two, and some are in sevens. You see? These creatures will come in. And how did they come in, you know? How did they come in? You look at verse 8 and verse 9. What verse is that? Verse 9. Noah walked with God, he said. And we move on to this chapter 7, verse 7. So Noah with his sons, his wife, and his sons' wives went into the ark because of the waters of the flood, of clean animals and animals that are unclean, of birds and of every creature that creeps on the earth. Two by two they went into the ark to Noah, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. See? Now what happened is God somehow made it easier for Noah. Okay, Noah, this is what I'm going to do. Seven of each clean creatures, two of each of the other animals, and all insects, all snakes, all crawling things, I'm going to cause them two by two to be saved. Did Noah have to quickly single out, you know, point out and search out what animals have been left out? No. God is in control of the life of everyone on this earth. He just somehow moved these creatures, that those who were chosen to live, they somehow came to Noah, two by two, sevens and twos, they came in. Noah just had to wait, okay, you, go upstairs, okay, go downstairs, okay, you hang on the walls here, you know. Noah just, let them in, because God moved them. God moved them and drew them to Noah, and they came in. And so the time came when Noah was told to shut the door. And what happened? What happened? Verse 11 and 12. Look at what happened. In the 600th year of Noah's life, remember I told you earlier that people lived hundreds of years in those days. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep was broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened, and the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. So for 40 days, for 40 nights, the rain fell non-stop. And at the same time, the waters from below the ground, underground water burst open, the earth somehow moved, and the cliffs, or the cleavage in the ground moved in such a way, the water gushed out. And from below, you see water. From the top, you see water. And certainly, there was climatic changes in those days. And we know that somehow it was affected. God controlled the weather and the seasons, because later on, when he made that promise to Noah that he would not do it again, in chapter 8, verse 22, we are told, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and the day and night shall not cease. So it indicates to us how God did it. God has the power to bring all this about, and he just caused the weather to change. He caused the world to be turned upside down. He caused the mountains to sing and the sea to rise, and he caused the earth to split and all the hidden underground water float out. And at the same time, that firmament that has been hanging above the earth all this while, which was carrying water, it appeared that in those days, whatever water just go out, and somehow it was refreshed. Now there's no real actual rain falling, but from that day onwards, somehow all is condensed, became dark, heavy, and the rain poured down, until the whole world began to be filled. And you thought, really, this part of Malaysia is being covered. And you see, striking further, from Kuala Lumpur, where to Seremban, where Port Dickson was covered. And you look, you see, Johor Bahru was covered. And you thought that would be the end. No, it goes over to Sarawak and Sabah, you see, all over. And you discover all the mountains were covered. And you thought, these are hills, small hills, and next to my house only. And you heard that the next thing is Gunung Ta'an is covered up. Mount Kinabalu is covered up. And Mount Everest, if you have facts in those days, I email people who say, even Mount Everest is being covered up. Now what I'm trying to say is that it was a worldwide flood, a colossal flood that you can never imagine. You see, it happened. You see, it's a worldwide flood that thoroughly destroyed the people and the creatures in those days. For 150 days, the flood remained and covered above the mountain tops. See, there was major upheaval and movements of the ground. Verse 17 to verse 20, see, even the mountain tops, the hills and whole heaven, see, and verse 20, the waters prevailed 15 cubits upward and the mountains were covered, and all flesh died on the earth. That was what happened, see. So it was a worldwide flood. And after the 150 days, the flood began to decrease. But all the creatures have already died except those in the ark. And it is very clearly recorded for us in verse 18 and verse 19, verse chapter 7, that the flood was worldwide. And you know what happens when the flood rises, the water covers everything, and for 150 days before it begins to decrease, you can imagine. At first the water is swirling everywhere, movement, flow, everywhere you find water flowing. Some swept away, some try to cling for dear life, but again they are drowned, you see. And so either the water was moving, water bursting, there was movement. Okay? Then as the whole world was covered, and then for 150 days it remained there, you can imagine, you see, the heavier things will sink down first, see. And then there will be a layer, you see, of
soil covering. Then perhaps, you know, some big object will flow past and then stir up the soil a little bit, and then the next layer will come, and the next layer, as things settle, and soon you discover the top layer of the water will be clearer, clearer, clearer. See? And then the water begin to recede. So when everything settles, what do you think you will find? If you were to be able to slice the earth straight down, a dig, and then you look at the strata, see, what you see will be one layer, one layer, one layer, one layer. And what you see will be the trees will be stuck over a few layers, and the animals will be dying, and some are struggling, you know, all in different positions, and some with food in their mouth, and that would be what you expect, isn't it? That is exactly what we find of the earth today. You go around the world, you discover the fossils show that is what is in. In Germany, for example, they dug, they discover a bar of this tree trunk that has turned into coal in the ground, being straddling a few layers. And archaeologists and evolutionists come and say, you know, this layer at the bottom must be how many million years? Maybe 100 million years old. Then the next layer is 50 million years. The next is 10 million years. But to their amazement, suddenly they find this tree trunk stuck and crossing over so many layers. They say, hey, how can that happen? The trees couldn't have survived all these years like that. You see, they can't explain it. You see? But the Bible explains that very well. The world is not hundreds of millions of years old. The world is quite recent. And it has been estimated it cannot be more than 20 million years old. See? And what happened is that the flood occurred, and that's why you find that phenomenon. And then in Alaska, the ice came. Huh? The water turned into ice. The weather now changed. You know, God made sure that the earth comes into a certain position at a certain axis and goes around the sun in a certain way so that the seasons will continue. The night and day will be there. So it turned out that Alaska would be a place which will be cold, and so the water all froze, you see. And today, people find to their amazement as they dig the ice, sometimes perhaps dig a hole to get to the fish sometimes, they discover, hey, this place, no water, this is ground. They dig, hey, what is this piece of leather, you know, hey, it's quite a big piece, and so this is fur, hair, they dig, they discover, hey, this is turned out to be a ear. Ear of what? As they dig, like an elephant. And as they dig, they discover, whoop! All the people in the world came, all the experts came to say, these were the mammoths of the past. The old type of elephants, you know, big tusks with big humps, you know. These are what we call mammoths. And one only. And as you discover, you dig some more, you discover so many died there at once. And as they discover, some of them have food in their mouth still. And some have their put in the stomach when they cut open. You see? This is what happened. The flood can explain this well. But archaeologists, evolutionists, using their idea of evolution, cannot explain this. It goes against their theory. And the so-called theory falls to pieces, but they still continue to insist that this is how the world began. With a big bang, out of nothing came something. And then we became amoebas. The amoebas began to crawl. Oh, and like amphibious, you know, like the tortoise, you know, from the fish to become something like a tortoise, and somehow become an elephant, and somehow become a monkey, and somehow become man. That is the evolutionist theory. You see? But it's not theory. It's a speculation. And in fact, there are so many things that contradict what they have put forward to us. And what they put forward to us are being taught in schools as though it's truth. And we are just absorbing everything. Oh, scientific theory, testing this, testing that, carbon dating and so on. What sounds so very grand, so believable. But when you study this carefully, stand back and observe what has been done. You see, so many assumptions have been made. What they say is not true. But the Bible explains clearly to us what happened. So you see now here that in the first place, we have learned why the flood happened, and we also now learn how the flood happened. For 40 days, 40 nights, the water fell. And then we come to what happened after the flood. Now, the third section, what happened after the flood?
A new start began from Noah. Now the mandate, remember mandate, that authority given by God, solemn responsibility given by God to Adam, was now passed on to Noah. It was repeated, although in a summarized form, in chapter 8, verse 17, we are told, "Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and cattle, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth, and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." Yes, in summary form, but it's clear enough. It's the same mandate that was given to Noah before, to Adam before. Noah now is like the second Adam. He came out with his sons, and from his sons the world began to be populated. We do not read of Noah having any more children. By that age he was so very old, and his three sons began to produce children, and the children spread all over the world. Now some anthropologists, by studying language, the languages of people especially, and by studying culture, and by digging into historical records of where certain people live in certain places, how they move across the face of the earth, they began to trace, and then they began to study the languages, and then they came to the conclusion that certain groups of people came from one son of Noah, another group of people came from another son of Noah, another from the another son of Noah. Others, they are not too sure. Perhaps, you know, these descendants, huh, intermarry and then produce this group in between, and this, you know, and so there's a lot of interaction here and there, intermarriage. So although some people claim they can trace all the way back to Noah, one of Noah's sons, the fact is that nobody can be absolutely sure. But what we can be sure about is we all certainly descended from the three sons of Noah, because they were the only people around at that time. The whole world was thoroughly destroyed. See? And that is why you take a very dark person and take a very white person, you put them side by side. At one glance, you think they are so different. But actually, you examine closer, you see, actually, are they that different? Are they like the so-called aliens that are pictured in the television? No. They're one head to one head. You see, two eyes to two eyes. One nose. 2 ears to 2 ears. One mouth, yes. When you cut open, it's the same. The two lungs there, one heart there, one stomach. They are the same. Then you examine their feelings. You see, they are capable of being angry. You go there and pinch their nose, you see. Still be angry and want to punch you, see? And human beings respond the same way. And you go and kill their cow, for example. You say, "Hey, that's my cow, you have to pay." See? Then you go and steal their wife, for example. "You come after you, you know." You go and burn their house. You see? They're capable of the same joy, same fear, same happiness. You see, same hatred, same anger, same jealousy. We are actually the same. The difference is only skin deep, literally. You know, scientists have properly examined this and say that, show to us that it is only the amount of the melanin, the amount of coloring beneath our skin that makes the difference. Otherwise, we are the same. Then another observation is this. If you look at the people in China, you see mostly, Chinese people, you know, mostly eyes like this, you know, like this, bulging up, you see? Almond-shaped eyes, see? Of course, there are the exceptions. In some parts of China, you see beautiful big eyes, but still, generally, you can tell they are Chinese, Eastern people, because their eyes like that, bulging, you see? Not deep, sunken down, you see? Generally, it's this way, see? Right? And the color of skin, yellow, you see? Okay? Now, you look at the border of China, as you move nearer and nearer, you see India. The color of skin so dark, generally curly hair, sharp features, you know, sunken eyes. Okay? So different. You pick a typical Indian and pick a typical Chinese, they look so different externally. But as you move nearer and nearer to the border, from each side, from India's side to China's side, and from China's side, you move nearer and nearer to the border, you discover, you know, they become less dark, you see? And their features become more and more Chinese, and this part, they become darker. And somehow their features are more and more Indian.
And it's not surprising. The boundary is only artificial. Human beings create that boundary. When they fight wars, they claim the land for themselves. But originally people were interacting, intermarrying, carrying out trade and so on. So you discover the people then intermarry, therefore you discover some of the characteristics is more Indian typical and some are more typically Chinese. So you see the mixture there, see? And that also helps us to understand that actually we are all descended from the same parent, Adam, from the three sons of Noah. We all actually come from the same source. So if that is the case, then all racial pride and racial strife is so stupid. We're so foolish claiming we are pure Chinese or pure Caucasian or German or whatever. Fighting over how pure we are, how great we are, we forget, we actually descended from the same parents, okay? All the differences are superficial, all the fights over racial things are so foolish and so unnecessary. But what we need to take note of is because we are descended from the same parents, we share the same nature, we are so sinful, and that is why all the strife and pride and jealousy occurs. So we must trace things back to the true cause, namely sin in us. Now back to what happened in the time of Noah. You see, God made a covenant with Noah, who was the second Adam, who was representing the whole human race, and to whom the whole creation was connected. See? God promised to Adam, to Noah, and to all creatures after him. You see? In verse chapter 9, verse 8, it says, "Now God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, And as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, every beast of the earth with you, of all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth. Thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." Now what God covenanted or promised solemnly to do is that from now, from that time on, God was never again going to destroy all creatures. And although he says that flood, we can see that actually God took pity on man. The whole human race had forfeited the right to live, and therefore he wiped them out. But now he wanted to start afresh. And he knew very well that Noah and his sons were also sinful creatures. And by grace they have been kept in their faith, they have not gone the way of the world. Okay? God knew that very soon sin will exert its ugly head again, just like that serpent that is kept under the basket. Take away the lid and the head of the serpent will come out, ready to strike. And the serpent in us is always there. Sin will soon trouble the world again, but because God had pity on man, on the human race and all the earth, he saw all of them destroyed, almost like a potter. You make a pot, slanted, crooked, and a few good ones, the rest, rub them together again, start afresh. You see, your own creation being crushed. God says, "I will never do that again." In mercy, out of pity for the human race, he said, "I will never do it again. Not by flood," and we can take it that not by nuclear war, by any other means. It is promised to us that when Christ returns to judge the world, there will still be people in the world to be judged. So the world is not going to be destroyed by a nuclear war or anything like that. That does not mean that we are going to be relaxed and irresponsible and just allow the bombs to explode everywhere. Of course we must exert our responsibility, persuade one nation and another from having nuclear weapons and so on. And God is going to use all this to restrain everything. There will be a bit of destruction here and there, but overall God has said that there will still be the human race when Christ comes to judge the world. God really will keep his promise. He will never destroy the human race again.
But the reality of sin must be noted. Sin will affect man such that man, if they are not careful, will again offend God. And that is what we are seeing today. Today, the human race is again offending God in so many ways. And that is why our only hope is in another Adam, Jesus Christ. The last Adam will come, and he will restore, redeem for himself a new people. And we shall learn more about him later on. But what we learned is that when Noah came out of the ark, the first act he did was to worship God. He worshipped God. He showed that he was a godly man. In verse 20 of chapter 8, then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. He kept the truth and the faith and the true pure worship alive. And it was passed down. And that's why we are not surprised that some cultures and some people still retain the knowledge of the truth. And in fact, some people have done research on this and shown that the Chinese civilization, which is so long, going back thousands of years, they have this knowledge of Shangti, the Shangti, the true God, and the worship and of birds, sacrificing bulls and so on, before it was diluted and adulterated with all human ideas. Before that happened, they already have been keeping alive that knowledge. And even in our part of the world, if you go to some of the distant kampongs, to some of the orang aslis and so on, sometimes when there is a quarrel and they want to settle something, they want to tell the truth, they say, you know, sembelih ayam, potong ayam, see, slaughter the chicken, you know, shed the blood. Why? The rough idea is that, you know, we call upon our gods, whatever gods there may be, to be witness among us, with the idea of sacrifice. And when they want to worship, they bring animals, bring fruits and various kinds to appease God. Now all these are the truth that has been adulterated, that has been mixed with a lot of errors. So we are not surprised to find that. But at that time, Noah taught his family to worship God by offering up the right type of animals as sacrifices, showing to us that one day, God will send the perfect sacrifice to be our Savior. So, in conclusion then, we see that the great flood was because of the sin of people, and God spared the human race through Noah and have a new beginning. Why? It was because God was showing His grace. He was showing Himself to be gracious by giving the human race a new start through Noah. So God was gracious in giving the human race a new start through Noah. Let us pray.